I want to ask a very simple question to you. Why do you think it would have been important for the National Guard to be in Ferguson on November 24th? And what impact do you think it had that they weren't there?
Well, I think that we had too many police officers taking up positions where the National Guard should have been stationed, protecting municipal buildings in Ferguson, instead of freeing them up to go out and patrol and engage, you know, the arsonists and the other rioters along West Florissant and some of the other parts of the community. We were told that the National Guard was going to be there for the municipal buildings, again, for the hard targets, so to speak. And because they were not there, the law enforcement officers who could have been in the streets, who could have been out engaging the public, who could have been out protecting those businesses, were instead forced to protect other buildings such as the police department, fire department, and city hall. And so I think that that made a huge difference, the manpower shortage we ultimately had.
Did you have any idea on November 24th that they had called out the National Guard not to be in Ferguson, or was that something that you learned beforehand?
So what I learned beforehand was that the National Guard would not be protecting our individual municipal buildings. What I was told was that the National Guard would be at the command post in Jennings, which is only about a block from Ferguson, and that they would be available if needed. And so it was quite a surprise to me when I found out, A, that it was a delay in actually deploying them once the rioting started, and then also to later find out, even to add insult to injury, that they weren't even where they were supposed to be, which was only a block away. They were actually at Lambert Airport.
One thing I noticed before November 24th, and we talked about it offline, is that you personally had almost no line of communication with the governor's office, whether it was the Ferguson Commission, whether it was other things. It seemed like there was, and also, you weren't like at press conferences with him. He usually had Dooley and Slay with him instead. There seemed to be kind of a not so subtle effort not to keep you in the loop publicly or privately. Have you ever gotten any idea why that happened, and what impact do you think that had going up to November 24th?
I'm not sure why that was the case. I mean, I could say the same thing, unfortunately, for my colleagues in Delwood and Jennings, who were also obviously very much affected, who also did not receive any kind of lines of communication, who were left out of the loop as far as the governor was concerned. So, and I think that the one of the biggest issues with that is I don't know that the governor wasn't fully engaged with us, which was clear, or the I don't know that the governor really was getting the information from those of us who were out there meeting every day, working with individuals, seeing what progress we were making as a region, as a community. And so those of us who were on the ground, I don't know that the governor took the opportunity, and he didn't take the opportunity through us to find out what progress we were making or what was going on. And I think I think unfortunately that may have ended up showing in his lack of preparedness leading up to November 24th.
There was a lot of coverage before November 24th about Ferguson's government and how it was largely white and how it didn't reflect the largely black community. Is it possible that the governor didn't want to provide legitimacy to your government or wanted to keep it at arm's length given all that coverage, or was that not the case from your understanding?
Well, I can tell you that I've had many of these conversations with other elected officials, including many of my Democratic friends and colleagues, who have said that he's often not engaged with the legislature. And so early on, I think as early as August, I guess it was still August, when I contacted a few friends in the legislature who were Democrats and stated I was concerned that there was maybe something, as you mentioned, that he was trying to keep at arm's length, either from me or us as the city, from the government. Was it due to my political affiliations? And the response I heard time and time again was, this is just the way he is. And which was surprising to hear this from people in his own party, to say that he is oftentimes disengaged from the legislature. And again, you know, that's just what I'm hearing secondhand. But those calls did get to him. Those frustrations did get to him, because eventually I was brought into larger discussions, but never any kind of one-on-one. Well,
like, for example, I mean, some of the other mayors of large North St. Louis County municipalities, like Forest and Hazelwood, especially Hazelwood, they're either aligned with organized labor or they're, you know, big cogs within the Missouri Democratic Party. Matthew Robinson is the chairman of the state or the county Democratic Committee.
Right.
Do you think that, you know, if Michael Brown had been shot in either of those places, they would have gotten their calls returned because they may have had a prior political relationship with Nixon? Or do you not think political affiliation had anything to do with this?
You know, it's hard to say. I'm not sure. I think obviously having a close relationship beforehand would have probably helped in some way, shape, or form. Having no real relationship beforehand probably didn't help. I think there's probably a little bit to what you said, that there's this concern with aligning with the government in Ferguson because of the criticism that we were getting. But again, this is something I hear time and time again about our governor in that regard, as far as being disengaged from some of the decision-making process, so to speak. So I don't know. I don't know if it's political. I'm not sure what his decision was. I don't take it personally.
Yeah. Well,
just try to move forward.
What do you hope comes from those hearings? And what do you hope is the end result from you know, those discussions, essentially?
Well, I hope that we can get an idea of what the decision-making process was for the governor, what the thought process was for him leading up to the events of that night, as far as making preparations for what we knew was going to be a large amount of unrest, and hope to find out that there was no decisions that were made for any personal reasons or political reasons. If mistakes are made, mistakes are made. If there is a rationale that is given that maybe still didn't play out the way that he'd hoped, then so be it. But I mean, I think as citizens, we all need to understand the way our elected officials are thinking and making decisions for us. And so I think it's very important to know that. So far, the rationales given, reasoning given to date has been, the logic has not flowed with some of the other decisions that were made. They seem to be excuses, and I think it's important that we understand the true reasoning.
What do you make of when he says, for example, he didn't want the National Guard there because he didn't want another Kent State, which kind of implies that there could have been violence or death if there had been clashes there?
Well, I mean, again, that's one of the ones that I don't think the logic flows. I mean, why put National Guard troops in Clayton or in Shaw Park neighborhood where you could have still had violence and death? Leading up to that night, the Unified Command believed that Shaw Park would have had an outbreak of violence like Ferguson. They believe Clayton would have had a huge potential outbreak of violence like Ferguson. To say that you would protect those two neighborhoods and then not Ferguson because you didn't want clashes between National Guard and people does not flow with what the intel was. The intel was that there was going to be problems at those places, at all three. Now, it all played out in Ferguson. I mean, that could just be dumb luck. Could be because people knew the National Guard wasn't going to be there. I don't know. I'm not sure why it all ended up happening in Ferguson. But the next night, he risked having a clash by putting National Guard on the streets in front of businesses that very well could have erupted again. It didn't. And thank God nobody was hurt on either night. Nobody was seriously hurt or killed. But the logic doesn't flow when you use excuses like that. And I think it's also, furthermore, very offensive to men and women in uniform who trained for this sort of thing, who actually, many of them that I met throughout this, many of these National Guard troops are actually police officers. The MP units, many of the men and women that I met with, they happen to be police officers in cities all across Missouri and Illinois. And so there was opportunities to get certified police officers from the National Guard to augment and, you know, supplement rather the efforts of the Highway Patrol and county and municipalities here on that night, and it didn't happen. And so I don't think that his excuses thus far are valid.
Well, let's move on to the city of Ferguson. in your view, how damaged do you think that the city's both reputation and financial status was because of the events of the last 6 months?
Well, luckily, we've had a very good financial situation for the past several years. And so, though it has been painful, we looking forward, the city is still in a good financial position. And so, obviously, one of our top priorities is to help get some of these businesses back open, get some of these people back to work who've been out of work, obviously, since November 24th or even earlier in some cases. And try to bring the economy back here in Ferguson, because those services and those services help provide for our residents, and that's important to them if they want to stay here. Obviously, there's a lot of people that still use the term Ferguson to mean a lot of things, and that's still hurtful to me, knowing what we've tried to make in this community for a long time. I think that that's probably going to be a stigma that's going to stay around for a while. What I'm hoping is that when people continue to look at Ferguson from here on out, that they will actually focus on what we're doing, and hopefully our actions will show people that we can rise out of what's going on, that people will see that and take note. It'll always be there, and I think you can go back to many, many places and many, many cities across time where terrible things have happened, and people will always remember that. But hopefully we'll remember what Ferguson becomes after that, not what Ferguson was in the fall of 2014.
Now, you mentioned the businesses, and I'm sure that there are still some businesses that are still damaged. Some are probably reopened. Some are probably burned beyond repair at this point. Number one, is there any estimate on what the sales tax or property tax loss to the city is because some of those businesses aren't open? And two, are you satisfied with some of the external funds that are trying to help some of those businesses, like the one from the Regional Chamber and North County Inc.? So that's kind of a two-part question.
Sure. So some of that, we don't know the answer to the sales tax questions because there's a lagging, there's a lag on collections. It's all collected by St. Louis County and then given to us in the next quarter. So we don't know where we're at as far as sales tax related to those damaged businesses. What we do know is from August, the quarter ending in September, we do know that there was a little bit of a lag, obviously, from August and September. And then we can expect that October, November, December is going to have one as well. We're not sure what it is yet. Property values, there hasn't been a reassessment yet. That's going to be in August. So I think we'll see then how that's going to affect us. We'll obviously be in conversations with the county assessor to make sure we have a handle on what to expect. And what was the other part of that?
Well, I'll restate the second question as a separate question. There have been some funds that were set up North County Inc. Mm-hmm. or the Regional Chamber. They got a lot of attention, in October and November, mm-hmm. that gave grants and low interest loans to a lot of businesses. And I've seen a spreadsheet from the chamber. It went to a lot of different businesses throughout the region. Do you think that's going to be enough to bring some of the businesses back, given that some of the grants and loans were like $5,000 and $10,000 and some of the damage might have been in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions? Or, is it sort of a situation where every little bit helps to turn it around, essentially?
Well, I think every little bit helps, but ultimately where we had to assess was, where's the gap? Sometimes the gap was individuals that had unrecouped losses because of loss of business, but not necessarily damage to their business. And so insurance doesn't necessarily cover that. So to have some assistance, even if it's $5,000 or $10,000, is very helpful. To those businesses who've been damaged or burnt down, some of them will be rebuilt by insurance companies. And because of that, obviously, the gap as far as what their losses are is considerably less than what it could be for others. But there are several businesses that were not covered at all from insurance companies. And so we're still looking at ways to try to assist those. I mean, there are still some who are not going to get what they need. Many of them are getting what they need, or at least getting something that really helps. But there is still, there's still a few out there that are not going to be able to come back because of the losses that they sustained and the lack of coverage that they got from insurance.
There's still some I mean, I was just at Hidden Treasures a few mm-hmm. minutes ago. There are still some buildings that are burned out and mm-hmm. still rubble from them. Is it fair to say that until that's cleared out, and whether that's still apparent or not, I mean, the scars of what happened over the last 6 months are still going to be kind of symbolically apparent throughout town?
Sure, and that's why we're working with like St. Louis County and others to try to get those cleaned up as quickly as possible, because it does, it's a sad reminder. And not only is it a sad reminder of what happened, it's just, it's not an inviting look for people who are, when we're trying to bring customers back to that area, when we're trying to bring developers or economic growth into the area. You know, having it cleared is obviously going to help with, you know, seeing that vision forward. So it's going to take some time. There were some environmental issues. Anytime a building's burnt down, the way that it's disposed of is a little bit more difficult than just tearing down other buildings. There's been some permitting and some inspection issues that counties helped us deal with. But when it's all said and done, we've got a hope that we're going to be done here in the next 2 months with clearing them all out.
I was told by one of my colleagues there may be a program for some of the youth in Ferguson to build or rebuild some of the buildings. Mm-hmm. Could you kind of elaborate on what that's going to be and how it's going to parlay with the healing process here?
So none of the commercial buildings that I know of are going to be utilizing. The only group that I know of is Youth Build.
Yeah, that's what I was talking
sure,
about.
Yeah. And that's residential based. There is some commercial. They can do some commercial build outs, but typically residential. And we're working with them right now to focus on properties that need either completely renovated or maybe additions built onto them. And so we're working with them. Also another group called Rebuilding Together to help people who may have some deferred maintenance issues on their homes, to help them get assistance. Youth Build is exciting because not only is it going to help improve the housing stock and help fix homes and improve the neighborhoods, but it also is a training tool in which young people will actually learn a trade on the job and earn credits towards getting their GEDs, because most of these are actually high school dropouts, and then also working their way into a trade union and actually completing a Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training certified apprenticeship program. So it's very exciting. That program especially kind of, you know, hits two birds with one stone.
You know, is there anything the city government, you know, city government touches a lot of people's lives, but it has limited amounts of power. Mm-hmm. Is there anything the Ferguson municipal government can do to build those types of bridges between the African-American community and the white community here?
So, you know, the city of Ferguson, as early as the early 90s, that was something that we focused on with a partner group called PROUD, People Reaching Out for Unity and Diversity. And so the city of Ferguson has, through our neighborhood associations and through many of our neighborhood efforts, tried to bridge gaps between people, whether that's owners and renters, between haves and have-nots, between law enforcement and the community. And one of the things that we're doing that we haven't done in years is try to have some more of those conversations about bridging, you know, gaps between, you know, African-Americans and white Americans. That's something that we started to do early on, maybe in September, October, started to have some conversations. And we've actually kind of passed that torch on in some ways to some other neighborhood groups and other associations who are continuing those discussions. But the city of Ferguson right now, one of the things that we continue to do is try to be that place where we can bring all those resources together. As you said, a small city government can only do so much, but what we can do is try to connect people and resources and connect people with programming. And so while we did start some of those conversations, there's several other groups in the community now that are continuing those conversations, and the city of Ferguson is trying to work with them to help promote that.
What do you think the future holds for the police department?
How so?
Well, there's an investigation going mm-hmm. on federally. You know, I guess there's been kind of errant talk of St. Louis County taking it over, but I think that's much more difficult to do since you're a charter county and you would need to vote on it. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's possible there could be changes to the police department that's kind of put on by the feds, essentially. Is that your understanding? And how do you think the police department will change
going forward? The feds can make recommendations, or they can ask us to do things in order to force us to do something. They have to sue us in court. Mm-hmm. The city of Ferguson has been changing for many years, especially in their police department, bringing ourselves up to the 21st century in technology and training. Chief Jackson, when he first got here, the first thing he did was really look at minority hiring and recruitment. It's something that we've been committed to and are redoubling our efforts on. And he also promoted our first two African-Americans to supervisors. And so those efforts have been ongoing and will continue to happen. We've got a department where there's some young guys, and there's many guys who've been here 25, 30 plus years. So yeah, there's going to be changes at some point. People will retire and new people will come, and new technology will come, and we'll try to implement it when it's suitable. But we have no intentions on getting rid of our police department. We have not gotten any indication from Justice Department at this point what we think those requests might be made of us as far as changes. I mean, I've heard Eric Holder say things like wholesale change, and what does that mean? I have no idea. We've got no indication what that means. Right now, I can tell you that the citizens I hear from, by and large, and this is even from citizens who have been involved in protests, want nothing to do with St. Louis County Police. Many people, for whatever they may feel may be wrong with a local municipal police department, feels that they have the most influence over a local municipal police department. Mm-hmm. So if they wanted to see something change or improve or otherwise, they would have a better opportunity to do that here. And so we're committed to having our municipal police department. The men and women in Ferguson Police Department have stuck with us throughout this, and we're very happy to see that. And I think moving forward, they're very excited to see what the future brings. I know that there are some questions, but the city is standing by our police department.
Over the last few months, there's been a lot of focus on how the city government works. I think there's been misconceptions about your amount of power that you have. Some people thought you've had an immense amount of power, when in reality, you're only as powerful as the council is, basically. Mm-hmm. You don't have administrative power. What can you do personally as the mayor? Because you're going to be mayor, you have 2 years left in your term.
Correct.
What do you want to do personally to kind of move the city forward, and how much sway do you think you're going to have in the policy making discussion going forward?
Well, I mean, I think we'll have to see what happens in April and the April elections to see that we have, we'll have 3 new members of the city council. And so we'll have to see what the council as a whole wants to do. I think from the conversations that have been having across the city, people are really focused on community development, economic development, a lot of the things we've always been focused on. I think there's a recognition both from policymakers and from the community that we need to do better in improving our communications. I think throughout the last 6 months, we've seen a lot of people make a lot of demands of the city, have a lot of questions of the city, feel the city should be doing a lot of things. And we've also seen a lot of people become educated about what the city has been doing and what the city has been focused on and what the city is doing to move forward and has been for a long time. So one of the things we've recognized is we've got to do a much better job on communications, because we have done tremendous things and people don't know it, even our own citizens. We do have tremendous things in the work, which include efforts along West Florissant, which was what a lot of people were upset about. Why isn't West Florissant getting the attention it needs? I think moving forward, we'll continue to work on some of the economic development over along the West Florissant corridor, as well as the Great Streets program to beautify and rebuild that transportation corridor. And even though as mayor, again, I don't have any executive or administrative authority, there is there's the power of the pulpit, I guess, so to speak. And right now, the council's, I think, moving forward pretty united on those efforts. The citizens seem to be pretty obviously united about what we wanted to do along West Florissant in that corridor. And having the conversations I've had with a lot of businesses and economic development professionals who want to work in this area, I think that we'll see a lot of great things happen in the near future.
All right, my last question is, it goes back to a conversation he was having with the mayor of Pasadena Hills 2 or 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. He predicted that one of the outcomes of the Ferguson unrest would be kind of a reluctance of ordinary people to step up and run for municipal slots because of the amount of pressure, our scrutiny, our, you know, criticism people get. I'm sure you were getting some level of that before August 9th, but it was an unprecedented level afterward. Do you think that he's right? Do you think that one of the results of this is people like you who maybe want to run for municipal office may think, no way in hell am I ever going to do that again? Or do you think that there's still a place for people to run for some of these offices, even if it invites a lot of scrutiny under really intense situations?
You know, I haven't looked yet to see what the filing was like in cities across St. Louis for the April elections, but I mean, I think that's an interesting point. Something that was stated early on was, look at everybody who's upset in Ferguson. You know, and then on the Friday before filing closed, there was 2 seats that were unopposed. And in an article, actually, I the only reason why I think we have 2 people that filed for those seats was because an article made a big deal about it, and 2 people went out and filed at the last second. I think that there's a lot of individuals who probably looked at it and said, why is that worth it to anybody? I mean, I get that a lot. And to me, you know, it's part of my public service. It's part of me being committed and dedicated to this community. Now, but that's still a lot for anybody to ask. I mean, not everybody's going to go through, hopefully no one else has to go through what, you know, we've gone through in Ferguson, or I've had to go through as mayor. But there is an intense amount of scrutiny right now against municipalities. And some of it's some of it is unfair. Some of it is fair game. And so, but, you know, municipalities, in by and large, are citizen legislators. It is a very, very part-time job. And there is, for many people, especially in areas where you may have a lot of professionals that don't have a lot of free time, or in areas where you may have to work 2 jobs to make ends meet, where do you find time to do what is now expected out of municipal officials? The expectations, especially since August, that have been made of myself or other council members, or even cities across the St. Louis region, in some ways is a little unreasonable. And I think as you see that play out, look now to the April elections, how many people have stepped up to want to run for that. Most people, I think, recognize that that's a commitment that's difficult for most people to make.
Yeah, and one more thing. With Senate Bill 5, mm-hmm. what do you think the impact would be on Ferguson if eventually can only have 10% of fines for its budget?
Well, you know, it'll all depend on, you know, I know there's a few caveats that they wrote into the law. I don't think it's going to have any effect on Ferguson. You know, Ferguson is at 15% now, mm-hmm. and you know, cutting 5% out of general revenue would be difficult, or finding some other alternative funding source. You know, that would be difficult and painful, but you know, we can do it. And but there's a few different caveats in the law. I don't know how much of it that fit. That 10% is not a hard and fast number, from what I've read after it came off the floor. I don't expect it's going to pass the way it is from the House. I've talked to a lot of legislators who have doubts. The 10% is a very arbitrary number. You know, I studied public administration, municipal government. I've never heard or seen anywhere where somebody came up with a number that comes from fines and forfeitures that is the healthy or optimal number as far as a city revenue source. So I think where the real discussion needs to be is in courts, is the question that you get 10% of your funding, or 11 or 12 or 25% of your funding from fines and forfeitures, really the issue that people are angry about? Or is there something else? Is it how you're treated once you get in the system? Is getting pulled over for speeding, I mean, if you break the law and you're speeding, is that the issue? Or is it because people add, you know, in the court systems, and we've heard about this, adding fines and fees and surcharges and other things along the way until your $100 speeding ticket becomes a $1,000 debt to the city? Is that the issue? And so I think by just saying that the number somehow is 10% or 5% or 15% is probably not really where the discussion should be had. The discussion should be had, should a $100 fine end up to be a $1,000 fine, and what's reasonable as far as the process goes and holding people accountable when they break the law, and making sure that that cities are not doing law enforcement for the purposes solely of raising revenue, and their court systems are not operating in a fashion in which they make it almost impossible to get out of debt with the city. I think that's really where the question, I think that's where the policy question should be and where the law should be focused on the law changes in the future.